Today we have Jonathan Kloberdans with us, a filmmaker whom directed a beautiful movie Dream at Sea.
Pozdrav svima, mi smo Bela i Mia, dvije roze koze. Budite uz nas svaku srijedu kad otvaramo novu temu. Stay tuned.
Hello Mia, hello Jonathan.
Hi Bella, hello. Hi Johnny. How are you doing?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm great, yeah. Appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
You grew up in Colorado on the ranch and you were homeschooled. I would like you to share something about that and about your journey of becoming a filmmaker.
Right. Well, every time someone asks me, why were you homeschooled? They say, were you, you know, born into a religious family, like a Mormon family? Because usually in America, people who are homeschooled, they don't think the state can educate their kids as good as they could. But I tell them no, the only reason that my mom started doing that is because my brother was dyslexic and he couldn't pass kindergarten. So she said, well, I'm just going to teach him at home this year. And at the same time, she started teaching me. And then it just went from there to the rest of the five kids throughout time. We were homeschooled until I was in sixth grade. And she kind of made it up, but it actually at the time, and I just found this out, but it was illegal. It was illegal to do that. You were really supposed to take your kids to school. So she had to like fight the system to keep us at home. And we would do state tests every 2 years to prove that we were actually getting educated. And usually my mom would give us about a week to prepare for those tests and we would do just fine. But the rest of the time it was like, it was up to us. To study what we want to study and study what we were interested in.
Wow.
Which I think really unique. You know, when you're at that age, I was already encouraged to just follow my passion, whatever it was.
And your passion was filmmaking, yeah?
Well, I think at that age, my passion was, you know, cooking with my mom and riding horses. And she would, you know, we had a garden. And so growing food and cutting things out of wood and trying to invent things. And, you know, if I was doing math homework, because of course she had to give us some of the regular studies, I remember one day she gave me my math assignment. She said, all right, this should take you about 30 minutes to finish. And then I went into the room and I came out 3 hours later and she said, what were you doing? You know, because it was so relaxed, you know. And I said, oh, I went through 6 chapters, you know, so that way I don't have to do this for the next 2 weeks.
Nice.
So, you know, because I was really into it. I was like, I can do another chapter. Oh, I can do another chapter.
So yeah. Filmmaking, how did that happen?
So filmmaking, and I just started to realize how this happened because my dad actually just passed away a couple months ago. And I just found a bunch of videotapes everywhere in boxes. And I started to realize, wow, he was filming everything. He was filming our whole childhood. It was like, he always had that camera out, and it made me think maybe that's where I got the idea in my mind, just looking at my dad with the camera. And then I found this letter, and it said, you know, dear dad, I would like to purchase your video camera, because in our family, we had to write a proposal if we wanted to go play with our friends, like on a computer written proposal signed, you know, and had to get it stamped, you know, by my mom. And then it would be presented to my dad at like the family meeting on Friday night. And he would sit there and talk about the, you know, well, you know, you want to spend the night for 2 nights at your friend's house, but I think we can maybe cut that down to 1 night, you know. And so then he would approve it. But he would usually approve every request we had.
That's actually really cute and like, innovative. I might think about it with my daughter. It's cute.
Yeah, it comes in handy now. I mean, even with filmmaking, everything comes down to like a proposal. Hey, I want to make a film about bullfighting in Spain. And so make your proposal. And who are you going to make the proposal to? And so it's really applicable. But going back to that question about the camera, you know, I did get the camera. I made the proposal and he said, okay, you can buy my camera. I think he just gave me the camera. But this camera didn't have a battery, so I had to plug it into the wall. So I would just plug it into the wall and like interview my brothers or my sisters about life and things. And yeah, that's kind of the beginning.
How old were you at the time?
I was probably like 13 or 14. And then, you know, as the years went by, then I went to university and I studied business and computer science. I thought, you know, computers are the future. I should just study computers. But then I failed. Well, I got like a C in one of these economic classes. And they said, you have to take this microeconomics again in the summer to get into the business school. So I thought, I should take a fun class. If I have to go all the way to the campus, I should take something fun. So then I looked at the course book and I found video editing. So I was probably maybe 19 years old. And when I went into that video editing class, I remember the professor, he went around the group and he said, you know, if you could make any film, what would it be about? And it was just like this spark in my mind. I was like, yeah, what kind of film would I make? And ever since that class, like it just really got things going where I thought, this is for me, you know, I can make money with this. This is my business. And I just went from there and never looked back, you know, got my own equipment and started shooting wedding videos and whatever I could find that I thought would be interesting, profitable. Yeah. So I also watched my brother as he, you know, would go and roller skate or skateboard, and he would come back with all these rollerblading and skateboard videos, and he would just cut it to music. And I thought it was just magic. You know, you see somebody doing something outside exciting, and then you put this action music to it. And it just was like, to me, like magic, you know. And I just, I think, fell in love with the art form of filmmaking. Yeah.
You got three sisters and brother, right?
Yes.
Wow, that's great.
How many movies have you actually done? Like Dreams at Sea. Is that like one of your main best projects, or do you have more of those?
Well, I independently shot a movie about an architect when I was probably 24. Before that, I was contributing to big films. Like there was this one film, it's called Light of the Himalaya, and it's about a doctor who goes to the Himalayas in Nepal, and he takes the cataract out of people's eyes because these people, they develop blindness in their eyes over time because they have very poor nutrition and because they live at a super high altitude. And many, many people, you know, even around 40, 50 years old, just become blind.
Wow.
So this film was about how this doctor was just saving people in villages, very remote villages, of blindness, because when you're blind, you know, you can't contribute to the family. You become a burden on the community. So this is a beautiful film, and I unfortunately didn't go to Nepal, but I did a lot of the pre-production on that film, and I did a lot of shooting in the States, you know, and that was an award-winning film. But after that, after working for that company for 3 years, I just decided I want to do it independently, and rather than focus on the theme of this company was like conquering big mountains like Mount Everest, and usually there was like a socio-humanitarian aspect, like this woman who, she had a heart transplant, and then 1 year later with her brand new heart she climbed the Matterhorn in Switzerland. But it was all based on climbing, you know, climbing, and I was like, you know, what am I interested in? And I was truly fascinated by the architecture of Frank Lloyd Wright. Are you familiar with his work?
Actually no.
No, me either.
He's this guy who, you know, a lot of people say he was the greatest architect in America. And this is in the 19th century when he was really developing his style of what they call organic architecture, where he would build with very little, and that he would build every home for a person, not just like a block building, but like, okay, if you're like a dancer or a performer, what kind of house do you deserve? And he would like spend time with them and research how they live and then build these beautiful buildings that would fit in with nature and which would be very efficient. So he was way ahead of the curve as far as like climate change, because now homes are producing so much greenhouse gases.
Yeah,
just by trying to keep them warm and because they're so inefficient. Anyways, I went to the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture, and that was my first independent film where I started interviewing people who were like between 80 and 100 years old. And they were just a vast wealth of information to me, not just about architecture, but just about the world and politics. And I would sit there and just talk pick their brains for like 2 hours or 3 hours. And that's why when I really realized like documentary has so much potential, you know, because everybody has a story, and often people aren't asked to really explain their story. You know, how often do people even really get deep into your personal life and you get to share things that you would never share? So that's what I thought, especially for older people, you know, it's a great advantage to like tap that resource before they pass away and that stuff's gone forever.
So how was the idea about the movie Dreams at the Sea born, and how long did the whole process take? What was your role exactly?
Well, at the time I was working in San Francisco and I was working for Apple, and we were just doing a corporate thing. It was, again, it was about architecture, but Apple being such a massive corporation, they can do whatever they want with contractors. And they just texted me and they said, hey, we're not working with you anymore, so send us your bill. And that's it. And I said, what? Just like that? I texted them. They said, yeah, we decided not to work on the project anymore. Okay, fine. So my partner and I were really just upset. You know, we had this great client and we were almost finished with the film. They gave us no reasons. And we just had this moment where it was like, what should we do? And sort of a miracle happened where this Syrian man, who is a very wealthy business owner in the Silicon Valley area, you know, approached my partner and said, look, I'm Syrian and I'm watching what's happening in Syria. And my family, they live in Syria. And I can't take it. I'm just so furious. The world needs to know what's happening. This injustice. It's like if Hitler was alive and nobody was talking about it and he was killing Jews, you know, and everybody just says, oh yeah, something's happening over there. That's like Syria, you know. So he really wanted to make a film. Well, he wanted to do something. So my partner suggested, let's make a film. And then I was the only one working for the company. So I became the chosen one to just go and make the film with very little guidance. And the idea was just, okay, what do we do? I don't know. Where do we start? And I, through a series of kind of coincidences, ended up in the epicenter of the crisis in Greece. And that's where the 10,000 refugees were stuck at the border. This is right around the time in 2016 where Germany had opened its borders to refugees. Mm-hmm. And that was great because they had nowhere to go and they were just trying to escape the war. But all these people started coming from Syria and then Afghanistan and Iraq and even different parts of Africa. And they were all coming into Europe. And then finally Germany said, like, oh, we can't take anymore. We already have 1 million. So they stopped their border. And all the other EU countries closed their borders within weeks. So there were all these different groups of refugees who were just stuck. Like, hey, my mom and dad, they just got to Germany, but I'm here now stuck in Bosnia. And they're like, well, you can't get through. So I was in Greece where like all these families were stuck. And they didn't know what to do. And most of them had run out of money by that time. They had already survived crossing the border from Syria into Turkey. They had survived living in Turkey and trying to make money or whatever. Some of them for months. Some of them, they just went straight to the coast where they could try to get a smuggler boat and get into Europe, get into Greece. And for those who then survived the sea crossing, they were in Greece. But then Greece, having been totally economically destroyed from their kind of micro-depression, yeah, they were offering very little, if nothing, of support for refugees. So they felt, a lot of these refugees felt just hopeless. You know, they thought that maybe they had arrived in Europe and that they would get some kind of help, but they realized they were just as screwed as they were in Turkey, if not Syria. Some of them wish they could be back in Syria, but at that point it's too late. So you can't go back to Syria, usually, if you left Syria during that time, because you're considered a traitor to your country to flee like that.
Yeah. You spoke on TED Talks in Athens about your work as director on a feature documentary film about the Syrian refugees crisis. And you start and end your pitch with a phrase from New Zealand, Turangawawe, something like that.
Right. Yeah, you almost got it.
So could you please explain what that word means and how you feel when you're filming war scenes and human sufferings? Lots of people would not feel safe doing your job.
Yeah, you know, first of all, to Rongo Wai Wai, it's that indigenous word from New Zealand, which it has a lot of meanings. You know, for some, like from the Maori tribe, it can mean to cut off the head of your opponent and bury it in the ground and sit on it.
Oh.
You know? And then other people can interpret it in other ways. They can say it means standing tall in the light where you belong. So it's like living your purpose, you know, doing what you truly believe you should do in the place where you should do it. And Turanga Wai Wai, for me, it's not a place. It's actually emotion, you know, because I feel like a nomadic person. And I feel like ever since I was young, you know, I was able to feel comfortable in situations maybe where others would feel shy. I feel like I can relate to people in a way that, I don't know, makes them feel comfortable. I just see people. I don't see color or gender. I don't know. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't change my... I just see them as human, and I know that everybody has a story. So, you know, when I went into these camps, of course, the first time I arrived, I was a bit frightened because it was like 2 a.m. And I don't know, it just looked like I was driving into the middle of a slum, and that like we could be kidnapped or we could be harmed. But then I got out of the car and I realized, you know, these are just people that are, you know, destitute and suffering a lot of psychological pain, you know, and not only that, but, you know, not having the resources to take care of your family. So I said, wow, like, I don't know what I can do, but I wanted to do more than be a filmmaker. Especially in those first days, I just decided I'm not going to take my camera to the camp for these first few days, because I saw other journalists and they were coming in and they were just putting the camera in people's faces. And I felt, you know, how would you feel if you were just out here like trying to survive? Maybe you were a successful business owner back home. Maybe you were a college student and now all of a sudden, you know, you got mud on your face and you haven't taken a shower in weeks and you're hungry and you're angry. And people are filming you, and that's a terrible feeling. It's like treating someone like an animal.
But at Idomeni, you met a family like yours, and you felt like you need to stick with them. So you documented their journey. What happened to them? Are you still in touch? Do you know maybe where they are now?
Oh, yes. So after I did spend those days there gaining the trust of people, and they said, what are you here for? And also I was giving rice and food and shoes and whatever I could. I, you know, I had a little bit of money. I could help families. Then I said, I'm here to make a film. And I don't know exactly what the film is about, but everybody had an amazing story. This family in particular, you know, they their father died the day that the revolution started in Syria. And I couldn't believe that. I said, how did he die? You know, because everybody assumes that, you know, he was killed, but he died of a heart attack. And so he died of a heart attack. And I think that's, it's from stress, you know, it's from, he was worried about taking care of his family and, you know, he probably had underlying disease or whatnot. But anyways, it made me think, you know, what would I do if my dad died? Or what would I do if I was with my sisters and my brother and, yeah, our dad died and then there was a war? And I sort of just started to learn from them about what they did and how they fled and how they got to where they were. And I think this family, I don't know, I just, you want to make a film about people that you want to be with, you know? And so I found, like, people that I just would be my friends in general and made a film about them. And they were so passionate about reaching their end goal. And it was the brother, his name is Ali. He was the one who took over for the dad at that time. And he really wanted to protect his mom and his three sisters. That was his goal. And he wanted to get to Germany because his girlfriend was there waiting for him, a Syrian girl. And that's probably the number one reason. Number two is that Germany was the only country at that time which is offering, you know, a monthly stipend for refugees, a place to live, a way to get educated for free, you know, just a process. And so over the course of those next, I guess it was a year, I stuck with that family. And I guess I could tell you what happened, or maybe, I don't know if I should say the ending of the movie. But if you wanted me to tell you where they ended up, then you're going to know what happened.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
I can tell you that they're all in a safe place now.
Oh, that's great.
But that it took a very long time to get there. And they had to take a lot of risks along the way. But ultimately, they reached a place where they feel that they can at least start their life again. One of the girls who's featured in the film, her name is Wissam. She's getting married, I think, this month or next month to a Syrian guy. Ali, the brother, who's also very fluent in English, which really helped the film to have English speakers. He got married and he has a baby.
Oh, that's beautiful. Nice. Don't tell us anything else about it. But do talk to us about your travels. You love to travel, and on one of those trips we've met, we spent like, 12 hours in Zagreb or so, something like that. Hey, but we managed to go for a coffee, so that was like time well spent, I would say. Yeah.
Yep, we could have chatted the whole time on the bus. But
yeah, I don't know why you didn't. I wanted to talk to you. Why didn't you? I was bored out of my mind. I was falling asleep and dying there on that bus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that was weird. Yeah, I don't know. Usually I just go through these phases where I feel really social and sometimes I get into my shell. I guess I was writing on my computer a lot and
No, you were drinking. You got so drunk, we lost you at one border.
I do drink and write, so you can do two things at once. But yeah, you're right. I probably had way too many beers and they didn't get caught. So
and you slept, and I really think you crossed the border in the toilet because everybody was searching for you. That was too funny.
Seriously? That's funny. I didn't know that.
So what are your plans for the future now?
Well, that's a good question. I would say a bit addicted to travel. I feel that maybe it comes from my homeschooling, where I feel like the best way to learn anything is by through experience. And you could pick up a book and try to like read about the war in Yugoslavia. But if you actually go and explore these countries and hear from the people in Serbia and Bosnia and Croatia about like their perspectives on it now or what happened to their ancestors, or just to see it and feel it, you know, then you know it. So that's what my true passion is. And I've been reading a lot lately about my ancestors. And my ancestors in the 18th century were, they were migrants. You know, this is back in the 1750s. They were living in Germany and they went to Russia. And half of them died along the way. And finally, they made it to the Americas. I mean, over hundreds of years. But they had a really hard life, and I really want to travel in their footsteps, you know, and see what they did and go where they went and to honor them, you know, and just to do another adventure where I get to see a different part of the world too, but more of like a personal connection.
That's very interesting. You dive very deep. I like that.
Thank you.
Yeah. On LinkedIn, it says you have extensive experience working in remote areas. One of such was your visit to Haiti after the earthquake. So I'm interested about your feelings and experience filming there, because, you know, we had earthquake recently in Zagreb, and it was a real shocker for me, especially with COVID-19 situation. And it was not even that strong and devastating earthquake like that on Haiti.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can imagine having an earthquake in Croatia at the same time of COVID. And then I can imagine, you know, the people in Haiti who, well, first of all, you know, it's one of these places where people are trapped. They're like economic prisoners.
Yep.
Their ancestors were slaves. They were brought over from Africa, dropped off in Haiti, and told to take care of the sugar beet.
Yeah.
Or the sugar cane fields to provide the sugar to all of Europe and America. So that's their story. And, you know, they deforested their whole country. They had no other choice, really. They were one of the first slaves that just had that uprising and said, we will no longer be slaves. So they got really hurt because of that, because the repercussions of, you know, the white settlers just leaving. But in Haiti, you know, on top of all of the disease and the extreme poverty that they're living through, they have the most tectonically active location in the Western Hemisphere. They're the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, too. But yeah, going there and seeing the aftermath of the earthquake was definitely changed my life forever. I think that's what really made me realize that, you know, we can do something. You can do something. And if it's through media or if it's just through like volunteering from time to time, I think that you get a lot out of it. It's a shared benefit. I mean, just to come back home also and realize like, wow, be grateful for just the little things in your life.
Yes, something we should all be reminded like of at times.
Right. I'd like to show people that, and I'd like to take people on trips to refugee camps and show them that it's not so scary, that these are people just like you and me, and you know, you could make a lifelong friend if you go to these camps and have like have an open mind about it.
Among many interests, you are also a big yoga and meditation lover. What I'm interested in is the sound meditation. I saw one of your videos on Instagram and I was really interested. Can you tell us more about it? Where did you learn? How does it actually work? What's the purpose?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'd say, well, the first of all, with yoga, my brother came home. He had started doing Bikram yoga. Are you familiar with Bikram?
Yes.
I never heard of it.
Right. Bikram is what they call hot yoga. And
hot yoga.
There's this man.
Hot
yoga.
Oh, okay.
It's done in a very hot room.
Uh-huh.
okay. It's all about sweating.
But it also, hotness helps with flexibility. I do the Ashtanga yoga and sometimes we do lead classes in very hot rooms, very steamy. It helps a lot with flexibility. So it's not all about sweating. Yes, of course, sweating is so natural at such high temperature, but stretching is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, stretching feels so good. It makes, I think without yoga, I don't know, I wouldn't be able to accomplish as much. The hot yoga is something that I don't do very often anymore because it sort of depletes your vital minerals and also the chi energy in your body. You shouldn't sweat that much very regularly. Some people do it every day, and it's super hard to get rehydrated when you do that kind of yoga.
Yeah,
like yoga in sauna.
Yeah, almost sauna, yeah. But that's how I got started. So I don't know. I'm thankful that at least I got started, even though in America it's considered like exercise, not yoga. So I don't do Bikram yoga anymore. Now I do like vinyasa and I dabble in hatha. But with the sound healing, I have a friend. He's from Mexico and he builds instruments that are replicas of Mayan tools that they use in ceremonies. And he's just broadened his, I call him the Leonardo da Vinci of Mexico. Like, he's a master artist and he makes things out of clay. He made me a flute, double chamber flute. So I use in my sound healing, usually I believe like sound healing, number one, it's very helpful because not very often do people just lay on their back in what they call in yoga, Tadasana.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just corpse pose.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're just laying flat Shavasana, on your back with your hands up. Shavasana, yeah. People don't lay flat on their back for like an hour. Why would they? You know, it's maybe it's boring or maybe you're going to try to take a nap, but just to do that, to be conscious about it and then to just experience the sounds around you can be a very meditative experience. And it's nice because it's with you and a practitioner. Not just you laying there listening to a CD. Like, it's very hands-on, even though you're not necessarily touched by someone the whole time. You're only touched by the vibrations. So now I'm using, I usually start with a flute, and it's toned to F sharp, and it's 4-3-2 tuning. That's the sort of the more higher vibration tuning. And F sharp is supposedly the earth tone. Like, if you go out into space and you're recording with a really high-quality audio recorder, there's a slight vibrational hum that comes from the earth, and that's around 4-3-2 F-sharp. So when I play that instrument, then people get really relaxed, and they get into their body, and they just start breathing and relaxing. And then every time it's different, but I have Tibetan singing bowls, and I have a didgeridoo. Sometimes I use my voice, and I use shakers to sound that sound like rain sticks. And I'm looking at some of my instruments now. I have an instrument that Ernesto, the Leonardo da Vinci of Mexico, made me. And it's this one's, it sounds like a jaguar, which is like roaring. And I blow that in people's chests, and it can make people a bit scared, but what it does is it just sort of washes away any fear, and it gives people more courage. Sometimes it sends, you know, like, you know when you get goosebumps mm-hmm. on your arms?
Mm-hmm. Could you do it right now, kind of maybe?
No, I have a better idea. Wait, do you travel with your instruments? When you travel around, you take them with you? Some of them, at least?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so next time you are in Zagreb, Bella and I are with you. We're so doing this. Right, Bella?
Yeah,
of course.
Sure.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, that sounds great. Wow.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I just bought a didgeridoo, which it's made in Switzerland, and it's made of fiberglass, so it's collapsible. So it's the first time where I'll be able to bring a full-size didgeridoo on the road.
Nice.
Which, exciting, yeah. It's good to have a little kit, but it's very hard to carry some of these sound healing tools, like this one Tibetan singing bowl I have. It, I don't know, weighs 15 kilos.
So this is actually yoga nidra, what you do, right?
It's not nidra. No, I would just call it a sound bath.
Sound bath? But it's similar because you also lay down and you relax and you enter this state between being asleep and being awake. Can you achieve it's the true. Same with a sound bath?
I would say the difference is that instead with yoga nidra, it's very guided with voice and symbology. Like the guide might say, focus on your big toe, now your second toe, now your third toe. So you hear it and then you send some consciousness to your third toe, fourth toe. But with sound healing, I'm not saying anything. It's just the sound. So I would definitely work on the first, the second, the third toe each. But I would do it with an instrument. And with sound healing, you have sound waves travel way faster through water than they do through the air. It's almost instantaneous. So when you send a didgeridoo vibration through like your heart and your chest, it just goes straight through your blood and it even goes into your bones. It goes into the bone marrow and it vibrates it. So it can shake up a lot of toxins and things and just move. It can move energy. It's stagnant. Sometimes people have like some energy which is stuck somewhere in their body, and that creates illness. It can create pain, and the only way to loosen it up and break that trauma point is, well, there's a lot of ways. Yoga is a great way, but sound is another option.
I want to ask you something about Burning Man. That is something that my husband and I would love to see before we die. And till today, I didn't meet anyone who was there. So can you maybe explain in 3 sentences or more what Burning Man is? And is it worth to be a part of it?
Sure. Yeah. The 3 sentences or more.
I mean, you know.
That's the hard part.
Yeah, I know. I know. I'll try.
Basically, I would call it, it's one of the biggest festivals in the world.
Yeah.
And it's done
and
in the
craziest
way that,
festivals, I think.
Right. It's like, you know, most festivals you imagine that you go there, you know, maybe if it's a camping festival, for example, you go there, but you can buy food and drinks. Just, you know, you go to the food court area and get what you need and. But here it's like an extreme survivalistic mentality where when you go there, you have to have everything you maybe think you might need to survive because you're in a desert,
yeah.
You know, and there's dust and it's not normal dust. It's not like a desert dust. It's like this thin, very, very, very fine powder.
Mm-hmm.
It's an alkaline powder. It's like the bottom, it's this place where they have it. It's the bottom of an old lake, like an ancient seabed floor.
Okay.
Beautifully.
So it's just a.
Yeah.
It's empty. There's nothing. It's flat. So it's a beautiful place to place art and to just, it feels like you go to another planet, honestly, when you go out there. But the nice thing about it is everybody who was going there has their own expectation of it. And those expectations become reality because human consciousness is so powerful that if we're all feeling, let's do this and like, let's be together, let's support each other, and like, let's have our dreams come true. And so they do. I just remember when I first got to Burning Man, I'm just walking through the desert alone and just wondering, wow, this feels like I'm walking on the surface of Mars. And I see this beautiful girl walking towards me from, I don't know how far away, like very far, but we kept walking toward each other, just like this. And maybe 15 minutes after we arrived at each other, we just looked at each other. We didn't say anything, and we just hugged each other. Then we just held each other and looked at each other and smiled. We didn't say anything, and then we just walked away. You know, it was just like those kind of things happen out there where people just feel overwhelmed with, I think, its place. And it's an opportunity to like reimagine your life. I think a lot of people who go there, they keep that energy with them, like this creative spirit for a month after the experience.
Yes, I heard because it's a so place empowered. To reinvent yourself and to actually just share this energy that is incredible. I also want to go there once. Yeah.
Really? So we can go together. and why? No.
No, I'm just joking. Of course
sound
we can.
Healing,
of course.
We could have a sound healing camp.
Yes.
Wow. And
or any kind of camp.
And why everyone's got bicycles there? I saw a lot of people.
The best way to get around.
Oh.
It's actually a very large.
But all kinds of bicycles, you know, craziest.
It's like whoever has the most interesting costume or bicycle or art car has the most fun because, I don't know, you just bring what you can bring. When I went there the first year, I thought, I don't know what I can offer people, you know, and I thought, well, maybe I'll do massage.
Uh-huh.
I was like, all right. And
okay.
So that was my thing. It's also based around gifting, I think less so as it used to be, but you really should arrive at Burning Man to serve the community in whatever way you can, in your own unique way. Like I had this idea to go out there one year with like 1,000 coconuts. And you just drive my bike around and I'll be giving coconuts away because it's so dry and people are so thirsty. But a real coconut with a straw and boom.
Wow.
Yeah, this idea is that I think this is how we should all live our lives, serving a purpose, some higher purpose. That's the whole idea behind the Burning Man, but also about the living itself.
I agree. I mean, it feels so good to give something to somebody who needs it. And like a refugee in the camp, I gave him some shoes, and I think it made me feel happier than it made him feel happier, honestly, when I thought about it. We can all do something. Every day, one little thing. Even if it's just listening to someone who maybe is sad or lonely. I think that's also very valuable. That's the thing you're doing with your podcast, I think, is you're encouraging people to share their stories, and so that's, and also get it out there to other people.
Yes, this is our mission, actually, to hear as many beautiful stories as they are. Collect them all.
Okay, so tell us, please, where can our listeners find you on social media?
Well, I have a website. It's called goodkarmafilms.com.
Okay.
And my Instagram is also the same name, Good Karma Films. That's probably the best place to go for now. I'm also starting an organization. It's called Frontline Stories. But from Good Karma Films, I'm putting everything for now. And Frontline Stories will be the going more to refugee camps and helping people tell their stories, but more of a short form, 3 to 5 minute clips, and empowering refugees themselves with those tools so they can become spokespeople for what's happening on the ground.
Your work is so very inspiring. Yeah. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun.
Bye.
Bye, Jonathan.
Ciao.
Bye, Mia.
Naš Insta handle je Roze Koze Podcast, a bilo kakva pitanja i prijedloge šaljite u inbox na rozekozepodcast@gmail.com. Nemojte zaboraviti kliknuti subscribe. To nam uvelike pomaže da ostanemo istinski svoji i nastavimo pričati o temama o kojima drugi šute.
Bok! Bok.